number two, The End of the Line. I'm Jeff Rentz. My guest tonight, Richard Sauder, Ph.D., who has written a very interesting book called Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? The book is available at $16.90 postpaid by writing Richard Sauder, S-A-U-D-E-R, P.O. Box 81543, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87198. Albuquerque is spelled A-L-B-U-Q-U-E-R-Q-U-E. And if you didn't remember at that time, we'll tell you again later. Richard, hour number two. We were finishing up with the air for underground facilities. Let's talk about clean water down there now.
Yeah, well, you know, a number of occasions during my research, I've come across references to actually excavating cisterns or reservoirs in the native rock, right out of the inside of mountains, the size of large ponds or small lakes, such that you would actually row around in them in boats.
Wow.
These will hold clearly hundreds of thousands or millions of gallons of water. There are also references to making wells for these, for water supplies, from underground in the facilities themselves. So you need not necessarily have an exterior water supply. In some cases, water is drawn for cooling and other purposes from underground, from nearby lakes and so forth. The facility at North Bay, Ontario, which I discuss in my book, run by NORAD, jointly staffed by Canadian and United States military personnel, draws some of the water that it uses from underground, from nearby bodies of water.
Very interesting. And with so much of the groundwater near the surface polluted, they probably got some pretty good stock to draw on down there, I would think. The problem of supplying these underground facilities with goods is done, I guess, by ground. We have heard much about the so-called black helicopters flying to remote locations at night. Could these somehow be linked to underground facilities?
Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. As far as supplying shucks, I guess they have storerooms. What can I say? I have talked to one gentleman who was an engineer in the Army Corps back in the 70s, and he told me during his training that he went into a couple of underground facilities. When I asked him where they were, he said, you know, I can't remember. So that's what you run up against. But he did tell me nonetheless that he saw hydroponic facilities in them. So it would seem that, based on what he said, that at least a couple of these facilities, and presumably more, would have some provision made for growing food in the event that they would close the thing up and have to remain sealed for a long period of time, grow their own food. And clearly, having hydroponic gardening or farming underground would serve at least a couple of purposes. It would provide food. It would also scrub carbon dioxide out of the air and kick back more oxygen.
And I would assume that power generating facilities for these could run from almost anything, conventional to nuclear.
Yes, exactly. And I have the documentation for that in my book as well. There's discussion in the literature that I've looked at of using diesel power sources, electrical power sources, as well as nuclear reactors to provide electricity.
There is a section of your book called Nuclear Tunneling Machines on the Moon with a question mark. Now, that's a very interesting concept as well.
Yeah, you know, I did an article on that topic for UFO magazine here about, a half a year ago or so. And I ran across some NASA documents during the course of my research that indicated NASA had some real interest in flying nuclear-powered tunneling machines to the moon to make tunnel networks and underground living and working and research facilities on the lunar, beneath the lunar surface. And these plans came out of Texas A&M, Texas A&M's Aerospace Department, Engineering Department, and also out of Los Alamos back in the 1980s. So, hey, who knows? Maybe NASA really does want to do that, or maybe if some of the rumors you hear can be believed, NASA might already be doing something like that.
The facility at Los Alamos, the Sandia National Labs, has been a figure of legendary proportions. You live down in that part of the country. What's the range of it?
Well, Sandia National Labs are on the actually on the grounds of Kirtland Air Force Base, just outside of Albuquerque. Los Alamos National Labs are in the county of the same name, north of Albuquerque, about an hour and a half drive. So they are two different facilities. They both they do similar kinds of research, however, nuclear research, particle beam research, electromagnetic research, those kinds of things. Very secretive, both run by the Department of Energy. Sandia Labs is run by Martin Marietta, and Los Alamos National Labs are run by the University of California system for the Department of Energy.
As far as underground tunnels there, you've heard quite a bit of information over the years.
Well, you know, the rumor that I've heard from several different people, not only from people in ufology, but even from a couple of so-called men in the street, is that there is a secret tunnel between Los Alamos and Sandia, or Los Alamos and Kirtland, and that there is a shuttle train that goes covertly back and forth.
We talked about maglev earlier. That's a term that may not be familiar to all of our listeners. You want to describe
right.
that?
Yeah, magnetic. It stands for magnetic levitation. It simply describes technology in which there would be powerful magnets embedded in a tunnel, such that when a train moved above it, it would levitate because it would have an opposing electrical charge. Not an opposing, actually, it would be the same electrical charge as the electromagnets embedded in the tunnel floor or the tunnel walls, such that it would repel, like charges repel. And it would float, if you will, above the embedded magnets because of the electrical forces involved.
Yes.
And then by pulsing the magnetic field and these electromagnetic coils in the embedded in the tunnel floor, tunnel walls, you would propel the train. Whether that exists or not, I don't know. Of course, the French and the Japanese have some prototype trains. It's a technology that does exist. It's not widely used commercially, and to my knowledge, at all here in the United States.
Yes.
It's a technology that is out there. It does work. Whether or not it has been secretly employed in covert underground tunnel systems here in North America, I don't know. And if you do, I would love to hear from you.
Overseas, Richard, there are a number of rumored installations. Probably the granddaddy of all is Pine Gap, said to be in Australia. And the U.S. is actually said to have three major bases in Australia.
Yeah.
Pine Gap being the deepest, which goes down maybe 8,000 meters, which is 5 miles, and that supposedly involves some kind of an antenna. But I've also been told that, as probably have you, that Pine Gap contains massive computer database capability, which literally monitors and observes most of the civilized world.
It's entirely possible. The NSA has a presence at Pine Gap. NASA does, Pentagon, the CIA. A lot of stories about Pine Gap. What is true is that it does exist. The security perimeter is very tight. For one thing, you got, you know, 500 or 600 miles of god-awful desert in every direction.
Yeah. Pretty good natural barrier.
It's a place that you don't go in unless you have the requisite clearance. So, you know, you hear a lot of stories about Pine Gap. Getting hard information is much, much harder.
Well, it said.
And there are underground facilities a lot in Europe. The Swiss have them.
Yes.
Sweden, England, France. The Rock of Gibraltar is one massive underground facility. The Saudis have them. Israelis, Chinese, the Russians. I mean, a lot of countries have underground facilities.
The Soviet Union have constructed underground facilities capable of holding millions of people.
Yeah.
That's something that the average American has never heard of, and it's apparently quite true. These aren't necessarily mile-deep facilities, but they are underground, and they were designed to shelter a rather substantial portion of the population from nuclear attack.
Yeah, that's the big difference between the Russian and broad outline between a lot of what the Russians have done and what has been done here. There is really no provision made for the masses in the United States in the event of a shooting nuclear war. The majority of us would be, to put a not too fine a point on it, nuclear missile fodder. These underground installations we're discussing in this program are for those in the know, for the military, political, financial, industrial elite. If you're not on the board of directors of a Fortune 500 company that has its own underground facility or facilities, if you're not a general or an admiral or essential technical support personnel, if you're not a senator or a Supreme Court justice or on the board of governors of the Federal Reserve, I don't know how to break it to you, but you're going to be out of luck.
Yeah, it is interesting. The Soviet program is huge, and they have obviously spent a great deal. Now, Russian program, of course, but that program is ongoing, I'm told. It's not stopping.
Yeah, well, I don't know much more about the Russian program than I've read in the popular press, but I do know they've done a lot underground. I was passed an article from Sandia's in-house magazine, Sandia National Labs in-house magazine here, about a year ago, regarding a tour, and this is a story that appeared on the public record, by the way, of a tour made by some scientists and technical personnel from Sandia Labs to an underground nuclear production facility in Russia, actually built inside a mountain where they have nuclear reactors and so forth underground beneath all the rock. So the Soviets do have a lot underground, including, the Russians have a lot of things underground, including, at least in this one case, a secure nuclear facility.
Yes. Chapter 7 in your book, entitled Nuclear Testing, the EPA Abductions,
yeah.
Animal Mutilations and Aliens. Very interesting. You've got a little different view of this whole animal mutilation and abduction scenario, don't you?
Well, yeah. There may be aliens here doing some abducting of humans and mutilations of cattle and so forth. I'm willing to give a hearing to people who say that they are. As you and I both know, there's precious little hard proof in that regard, and just hundreds and hundreds of stories.
And thousands and thousands of dead animals.
Yeah, right. Well, there's no question that a lot of animals are being killed, and it appears virtually incontrovertible that many of them are murdered and slaughtered by parties unknown. And in many cases, their bodies or their carcasses are carved up with some kind of surgical laser device. Now, I document in my book and actually show the front page of a news release that came right out of Kirtland Air Force Base here in New Mexico that the Air Force has and has had now, at least for a couple of years, a portable surgical laser that'll snap right on a belt. It's powered by dry cell batteries and has a surgical capability. So forget about it when people tell you that, a surgical laser, you'd need a power unit the size of a refrigerator and all this other nonsense. That's simply not so. The technology exists. It is known. It is publicly known, publicly admitted. The military has it. It'll snap on a belt, literally. The power plant for this thing is the size of a transistor radio, and it runs off of dry cell batteries. And it's here, it's real, so there's nothing in the world to keep a Air Force Special Ops person or anyone else from snapping one of these things on their belt and carving something or someone up. Now, I have a colleague who actually, there was a, knew someone on base here and who had one of these things and brought it off the base and went with her, and they went out on the West Mesa here and Bernalillo County, and they went to the grocery store and got a frozen chicken, and they sliced up this frozen chicken, so these things do work as advertised.
All right. Now, how about the abduction routine as far as you're concerned? You hang around the UFO community a lot. You talk to all the most well-informed people. What do you think? What's going
people
on?
People are being abducted. People are being abducted. And I've talked to now a handful of people, about four, I think, who have, I know personally and have spoken with more than four people who have been abducted. I have spoken, I believe, with four people now who have reported either they or people very close to them have been abducted by aliens in the company of the United States military, or by the United States military alone. So whether or not aliens are doing the abductions, it seems that there are also some military involvement.
Well, that gives credence to the idea that there may be some cooperation going on. Richard, we're going to take our break right now and continue with much more here at the End of the Line. News Talk, 1250 KTMS. We're back. The End of the Line. My guest, Richard Sauter. We're talking about underground bases and tunnels. What is the government trying to hide? We're looking at the UFO alien abduction aspect of things now, as it may or may not relate to some of these underground facilities. And we have a call now with Dave on line six. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering how they would staff these bases and keep people quiet, basically. And I'm sort of wildly speculating. Would they be able to grow their own kids, basically, or even maybe kidnap them and just have communities down there who never see the light of day?
There are penalties for violating security agreements, including being sent to the penitentiary and being heavily fined. And, 10 years in the pen and or a $50,000 fine will keep most of the people from talking most of the time.
He also brought up the idea, the concept of these underground facilities actually breeding children, by bringing their own populations online.
I don't know. You'll hear, I've had people tell me that there are resident populations that live underground, and that indeed there are families there, and that there are children who have been born and reared underground, who spend most, if not virtually all of their lives there, and so really know little of topside life and prefer living underground because it's all they know. I don't know if that's so. In principle, I don't see why that couldn't be possible, but I have no proof to that effect.
Anything else, Dave?
Nope, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Yeah, that is an interesting concept, Richard. I guess if children were confined underground and born there, they would be aliens, wouldn't they, of a sort?
Yeah, they'd be subterraneans, and I guess think about us, the claustrophobia of someone who is used to the wide open western skies, for example, and resigning themselves to spending year on end underground, and then flip that around 180 degrees and imagine that life underground was all you had ever known, and imagine what panic you might feel if suddenly you could see 100 miles in every direction.
It would be overwhelming, sensory overload at the least. As far as abductions go, we mentioned just before the break that there are many people. We've had a number of experts in the field on the program before, as you would imagine, talking about this in great detail, but there are more and more reports of people being abducted either by the U.S. military or by alleged or what appear to be U.S. military and aliens at the same time.
Yeah, I've talked to some of these people personally, people who are known publicly, and I've talked to abductees who are not known publicly and don't want to be. There appears to be a fair amount of it going on, and as you say, there are about three different ways that this seems to happen. Military units alone, and in most cases, amazingly enough, they're actually wearing identifiable military uniforms, sometimes even with name and rank right on the garment. Not really much effort to hide what they're doing, I guess, with the idea that what are you going to do? Are you going to call the county sheriff and have him go 5,000 feet underground in the middle of the desert and arrest someone?
Yeah.
it won't happen. So I guess they do have immunity, and this amounts to criminal activity. Kidnapping is a capital crime.
Sure.
And it's very serious.
Yes. Abductions also involve needles and implants, don't they?
Yeah. There are many, many cases where people report having needles stuck in them and having some kind of implant inserted in their bodies. A lot of locations are given, the feet, the legs, frequently in the head, in the nasal area, or around the ears, or sometimes around the eyes. My guess is that in the case of the implants at the top of the nose, they would be very near the ocular nerve, which is the nerve that goes from the eyes to the brain. The implants near the ears, oftentimes behind the ear, and that would be near the auditory nerve. My guess is these implants could be used to turn someone into a human detector probe, so to speak, in that whatever they heard or said could be detected and transmitted, and whatever they saw could be detected and transmitted. So they would be like a mobile, a roving TV camera, sort of.
And you're convinced that the technology to do that is probable?
Well, it certainly seems that someone is using it, and I think that probably the military-industrial complex has access to this type of technology. I think that covert, shady elements of the government, United States government, and other agencies, which may or may not be governmental, are involved, but human. It also appears that some type of non-human agency may be involved. Whether or not they're extraterrestrial remains to be seen. Whether or not they are natural beings and not biologically engineered either by us or by someone else also remains to be seen.
These injectable little transponders are quite small. What is your description of them?
Well, this technology exists. There are actually patents out there for these electronic implants. And I name some of the companies that sell them. The Fortune 500 companies are involved in this. General Motors, for example, has a subsidiary involved in this. There are other companies. I think Texas Instruments, for example, has a line of these electronic implants out now. They're very widely used for livestock and for companion animals, for pets. But they can be used for humans as well. And in fact, one of the patents, or actually more than one, three of the patents that I cite make very clear in the language of the patent that they are designed for use on animals, objects, and persons. So technology is out there to implant with needles these electronic injectable transponders, and they can be stuck just about anywhere. And where this will all end, I don't know, but I don't get a very good feeling from it.
Now, why not? What you must have some sense that clearly this is a rather dark endeavor.
I do.
You talk to a lot of people.
I don't feel like a cow, for example, or like a pet cat that I need to be injected and electronically tagged and monitored. The implications for this technology are potentially horrific. And the implications for possible totalitarian electronic monitoring and control of human populations are very obvious. It's bad enough now with the first generation of smart cards being phased in here and there. If you read the papers and the alternative press closely, or if you just observe what's going on around you, anyone with access to computer technology and able to get into databases can already have a frightening degree of influence and control over an individual's life. I don't want it to extend yet another level to where we actually have electronic monitoring and surveillance devices embedded in our bodies. That's scary.
Yeah, well, sure it is. Wouldn't there be a way to neutralize those?
Yeah, don't have one put in.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one. There is also a big shift in the abduction community now. as I'm sure you're aware of, a lot of the abductees in the last year or two or three have begun to now describe these experiences in very positive terms rather than the negative terms which were traditional. They're according to the people I've spoken to and who have guested on this program, is a major shift in some of the people who are reporting how these incidences have affected them.
Well, you know, I think it depends on the person. I think it depends on what transpired. I think it very much depends on what they remember of what transpired or what they think they remember of what transpired. It also depends on the nature of the entities involved. I know an abductee very well. In fact, I know two abductees very well, two personal friends who had horrific experiences and who are definitely not among this number who are saying, describing what happened to them in positive terms. These women just had some hellish, nightmarish, like experiences with a reptilian creature and also with a, I'll say reptilian seeming creature, and also with the smaller little gray type creatures. It appears that there's a very wide variety of experiences. Some people describe virtual angelic type of encounters. Others describe something on the order of a bat out of hell and everything in between. So I think it really depends on each individual and what's happened to them and how they react to it.
You're very pragmatic in your approach to this. These two women you described are friends of yours?
Yeah.
And obviously quite sincere, are they not, in telling you this?
I believe them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's not outside the realm of possibility that they were abducted by U.S. military or some type of governmental agency who could have easily had some of their own dress up in reptile hooded masks.
Well, you know, this is something I cover in my book. If you can even, I'll give you an example. I had a job at the airport here last year, and I one time unloading airplanes, and I was in the cargo hold of an airplane, and I came out, and the pilot of the airplane had put a rubber gorilla mask on as a prank to kind of flummox or befuddle the ground crew. And I looked at him, and for a minute I was stricken with terror. The cognitive dissonance was so extreme. And that when you look at a human being, you expect to see a human face and not a simian face. And when you see a gorilla looking back at you instead of a 6-foot human, it can be very frightening. And for about 2 or 3 seconds, I must confess, I was scared. It was a real visceral type of fright. And then I reoriented myself, and I realized that it was a practical joke. But alter the scene, put someone into an altered state of consciousness because of having an injection of a hallucinogenic drug, for example. Have someone in a complete reptilian bodysuit. Have them snarling. Have this person kidnapped and taken in duress to an underground facility and confined against their will. And you would have the scenario for a nightmarish, terribly frightening encounter. And that could be done with very off-the-shelf type of terrestrial technology. It would give the appearance of being an abduction by a seemingly alien, malevolent being, when in reality it could be someone, 6'6" male, who works out at the gym and has an Arnold Schwarzenegger type of build and a latex bodysuit, with some slit-eyed contact lenses to cover the eyes, and so forth. You see what I'm saying?
Sure, of course, yeah. Certainly then, I get your drift that you think the potential is wide open for anything.
I think, as I said earlier, 1995, we are living in a time of illusion, pure illusion. The puppet masters are working overtime. There are mysteries and enigmas within each other. Jacques Vallée, in one of his books, uses the metaphor of a hall of mirrors to describe this phenomenon, or these phenomena with all their many facets. And I pick up on that in one of my chapters and say, indeed we are in a hall of mirrors, and we see so many different reflections looking back at us, and fragments of reflections, And how do we know? Is it an alien reflection, a human reflection? Is it a reflection that's electronically generated, chemically generated, hypnotically generated, all of the above, all mixed up together? It's hard to say.
Really is, indeed. The puppet masters, are they winning? Are they meeting less and less resistance? Or are more and more people waking up, Richard, as you travel around the country and talk to them?
Oh, I don't know. Waking up to what? Maybe waking up to how confused and confusing a reality we're living in. I think more and more people are aware that there are games and scams within games that are being run from very high levels of policy and of government and of industry. So in that respect, I think more and more people are becoming more sophisticated than they were 10 or even 5 years ago. I still don't think it's a very large number of people. You know,
yeah.
We have a country of 260 million people. So if maybe 20 or 30 million people are fairly sophisticated and savvy and understand the scams and schemes that are being run and the propaganda mechanisms used to control the population, 20 or 30 million people is a lot. What about the other 200-plus million?
Right. How about the disinformation aspect, which is huge, and as you try to wade through it in and amongst the your peers in the UFO community and the research community, have you run across any obvious and open efforts at disinformation that you've been able to unmask or reveal?
Oh, boy.
That's a tough question, I know, but there's so much out of it, and it's all seemingly relegated to shades of gray, too.
Yes, and you got to understand the way disinformation works. A good disinformation artist or a good disinformation program will give you 100 pieces of information. 99 of them will be completely and absolutely true. One of them will be false, or maybe only partly false. Now you figure out which and in which degree.
Full-time job and no solution to it.
No.
Really? It goes back to instinct, doesn't it? Your intuitive...
Well, it goes back to instinct, and it goes to doing methodical research and not just falling for every story and rumor that comes down the turnpike, which is why that I, Richard Souter, write a book like I do, Underground Bases and Tunnels, with footnotes out the wazoo. It's why I go and just pour and comb through records and documents and journals and professional publications, sift through the minutiae in the detail. It's boring, it's tedious, it's time-consuming, it takes a lot of effort, but it can pay off. And there are other people who, and if you go to New Age and UFO conferences, you'll run into them, they're all over the place, who will sit down and tell you the wildest stories and tales for hours on end. Well, when you ask them for some proof or some hard documentation or even one photograph, they can't produce any of that.
His book, Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? An outstanding book, available for only $16.90. That includes shipping and handling to Richard Souter, S-A-U-D-E-R, P.O. Box 81543, Albuquerque 87198. Back with more after this. We're back, our final 10 minutes at the end of the line. My guest, Richard Souter, author of the book Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? Richard, there is something that occurred in your neck of the woods that has been running around the UFO rumor mill for years about an alleged base at Dulce.
Right.
In northwestern New Mexico, which allegedly is at least a joint UFO alien-type base staffed with some humanoids as well, which I guess is what we are,
yeah.
And that there were some of the scientists there at one point which were held captive in an effort to rescue them was undertaken by the Delta forces.
Yeah.
You've heard the story. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, I've heard the story. I've even talked to a guy who claimed to be involved. He's never provided me so much as one shred of documentation or any hard evidence as to where so much as one of these 100 rumored entrances to the Dulce complex are. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Who is this guy?
Well, I won't.
I don't need his name, but what kind of credibility does he have?
Well, not much with me because he hasn't provided me any corroborating documentation.
All right.
That's why I'm not going to mention his name. It's just a.
No, we don't need his name.
Another unfounded rumor, unless and until he and any of these other people running around, and he's certainly not the only one out there on the lecture circuit who say they have hard documentation, come forth with it. Let's see it. Let's go right there, and you show us all exactly where you go in. And if they can't do that, then I submit they haven't been there. I have been up to Dulce. I combed the mountaintop where the now somewhat mythical but very real Paul Benowitz said in the 80s that there was an entrance, pylons, a dome, air vent, etc., for an underground facility just north of Dulce, which is hard up on the Colorado-New Mexico border. I went and combed the mountaintop with a Xerox of a geological survey map and looked very carefully. I went contour line by contour line exactly where he had all of these things indicated. I saw nothing but very, very ordinary, perfectly ordinary rocks, bushes, trees, cliffs, etc. I saw no evidence whatever that there had ever been anything there that remotely resembled what he described. Now, I think I know that there are underground installations, there are underground installations here in the West, including two right here in this county where Albuquerque is located. My inclination is to think that the Dulce story is in large measure disinformation, misdirection, to have people beating the bushes literally in a very sparsely populated area of the Southwest to keep their attention deflected and diverted from other areas where indeed there are underground installations, and if they knew where those were, would spend more time paying attention to them. So, it's a classic case of misdirection. You wave the red cape at Dulce, and everyone goes rushing over there. Meanwhile, you merrily do whatever you want to, half a state the other direction.
Who was Paul Benowitz? That name keeps
Paul
popping
Benowitz
up.
Paul Benowitz is a research scientist who did contract work for the Air Force. He has a facility called the Thunder Scientific Laboratory right outside, literally against the fence of Kirtland Air Force Base, right outside the gates here in Albuquerque. Back in the 80s, he alleged to be picking up some kind of signals from little grays flying in flying saucers here in the vicinity of Kirtland Air Force Base, and he alleged to have received communications from them indicating that they had an underground facility at Dulce. And so that's where the story kind of came from. I'm inclined to think that maybe Paul Benowitz did pick up signals, but maybe he picked up radio signals being broadcast from Kirtland Air Force Base covertly with the knowledge that he was receiving them and that he was fed disinformation under the guise of coming from little gray aliens, but really coming from an Air Force disinformation project. I can conceive of that as one possibility.
You know, I got to think that people planning and actually carrying out disinformation projects sometimes must laugh a little.
No doubt. No doubt.
And wouldn't really be too hard to come up with something like that to take advantage of a serious researcher and simply tip him over?
Yeah, you know he's listening. In a code that you know he has the ability to unscramble. He unscrambles it. He finds out, by God, there's these little critters underground up at Dulce.
Has Richard Sauter come across many reports of lights and other craft unidentified in the area of some of the larger underground bases that you know are out there?
Well, I've seen UFOs right here in this county, and I have a number of friends who have as well. There are a lot of UFOs of virtually every kind of description seen here in New Mexico.
What has Richard Sauter seen?
Oh, I've seen solid colored spheres come over the mountains here, 1989. and all the same size, moving together, much as a cluster of billiard balls would look in the air if they were very large, you know, 40, maybe 40 feet in diameter.
How close were you to them, Richard?
Maybe seven miles away, something like that.
You could detect some surface on them then that appeared to be solid?
They looked solid to my eye.
Mm-hmm.
They were maybe about 4,000 feet in the air, something like that. Right over mid-afternoon on a sunny day with clear blue sky. And while I was watching them, one of them just winked out or disappeared or something. It suddenly was not there. And then the remaining four of them I watched move in concert back over the top of the mountain and out of sight.
And you mentioned there are many sightings in New Mexico.
Yeah. I'll tell you one happened this year. It was related to me by an airline pilot whom I cannot name. I won't say what airline he flies for either. I met this gentleman just about a month ago, and he was flying over western New Mexico in the middle of the night, headed from the west coast to the Midwest, I think, and he and his crew saw a very large, extremely large, brightly lit green object moving at they clocked at about 2,000 miles per hour that went past them, flying horizontally and then accelerated at a steep angle into the upper atmosphere and out of sight. He made the mistake of reporting this to the airline when he filled out his post-flight report and very nearly lost his job. This was just about 3 months ago. When you're a captain and you have a airline captain and you have a career, you think twice about that kind of thing. I don't think he will ever report something like that again. But he got on the radio to the control center in Albuquerque, and when he did, there were three or four other airliners in the air over eastern Arizona and western New Mexico that also jumped on and reported saying the same thing.
Well, I didn't know that I hadn't heard a story of the pressure still being that intense on pilots.
Yes, well, I know another airline captain who has had a similar incident within the last year or two. It's just that way. You stand to lose your job. It seems the airlines don't like people in the cockpit who see things that clash with conventional reality or the popular consensus as to what reality ought to be.
Well, that brings to mind the rather famous case of the, I believe it was a Japan Airlines 747 cargo aircraft over coming over the pole. I think it was over Alaska.
Yeah.
And the pilot reported something like half a mile or a mile long right next to them. And ultimately, the pilot's story was discredited. And reading between the lines, obviously, a lot of pressure was put on the pilot, and he was in the beginning trying to stand firm, but a lot of pressure.
Yes, lots of pressure.
As you travel around the country and do lecture on your fascinating subject and you meet people who are directly involved with the UFO phenomenon, who are some of the people you really have the most respect for?
I would simply say that indicate to people listening, I think that we involved in ufology and in Fortiana and related fields need to have high standards for proof. And to the extent possible, we need to substantiate phenomena, get hard evidence when it's available, ask tough questions, and at the same time, we need to remember that we are all human beings. We're real people. We have real lives. And we ought not to be too cynical.
That's very well said. We shouldn't be too cynical. Let's be open.
Be open-minded. We need to be open-minded, but without being cynical on the one hand and without being gullible on the other.
Well, that's a tough position to come up with.
But I think it's the one that we have to arrive at.
Are you getting more and new information all the time?
Not a lot of new information. Very few people with information, and they are out there, are contacting me. And it's for the reasons that we've mentioned a couple times earlier on this program. if people do have information, they can certainly forward it to me at my mailing address. The more detailed and the better substantiated it is.
And you will protect confidentiality?
Pardon me?
You will protect your sources, of course.
Oh, yes. If someone wants confidentiality, I will do that. I will definitely honor that. If they would prefer not to even attach their name to what they send me, and sometimes that happens, you can send me something anonymously, and that's fine as well. But if you don't want me to mention your name publicly, make that clear, and I will protect your identity.
So the research continues with Richard Sauder. That's S-A-U-D-E-R, and he can be reached at P.O. Box 81543, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the zip code is 87198. His book, Underground Bases and Tunnels, $16.90. That includes shipping and handling, some cash, check, or money order. To Richard Sauder, P.O. Box 81543, Albuquerque, 87198. Richard, thank you very much for the 2 hours. It was very enlightening and illuminating, and we'll talk again.
My pleasure, Jeff.
All right, have a good evening.
Yes, sir.
And thank you for being with us. I'll be back next Sunday, same time, same station, at the end of the line. Until then, this is Jeff Rentz wishing you good night and good luck.